Welcome to another installment of the Civitas podcast, which is an expression of the Theopolis Institute, in which we explore the theme of ecclesiocentric post-liberalism, seeking to develop and articulate what a Theopolitan contribution can provide to the ongoing post-liberal discourse. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Peter Lighthart, and a special guest, Dr. Veronica Ogle. She is a professor in the humanities department, a professor of philosophy and political science at Villanova University. She was formerly an assistant professor of philosophy at Assumption College in Massachusetts. She's also participated in various prestigious postdocs, for instance, the Tocqueville Postdoctoral Research Fellowship at Notre Dame, and then a postdoc in the James Madison program at Princeton. And she completed her PhD in political science at the University of Notre Dame under, I just recently learned when I was looking this up, that your chair was Mary Keyes, who also has written a really important recent book on City of God, which is what we'll be largely talking about. And I now see the stamp of that on your work as I've learned that information. But thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's so wonderful to have this conversation with you all. And I'm so glad to know about your podcast.
Well, we would have preferred that you already knew about it, but we're glad to make it known. So,
I would love to be more of a podcast follower. It's on my list of things to do, but I don't get around to it too much these days.
Yes, yes. Well, we're excited to have you on because we both love City of God, and I'm actually teaching a seminar on City of God with some students, and I've used the important book that you wrote. And I know Peter was actually familiar with it even before we talked about having you on. And that book is called Politics and the Earthly City in Augustine's City of God. And it was published by Cambridge University Press. And so that's largely going to be what we're working with in our conversation today. But before we kind of get into, you know, all of our various conversation points, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to share maybe a little bit what motivated you to write the book. What gap in the scholarship on Augustine and City of God were you maybe trying to address with this? And then also I did just want to sneak this in before I let you loose on this. I thought it was fascinating because your chapter one is your first chapter is framed around this theme quite a bit, but in the kind of opening page, you include a quotation, which it looks like is your translation. I couldn't find this being, I didn't know if this was a current edition of City of God of 11:13, where you talk about the devil attempting to rewrite or counterfeit reality. And yes. So I was interested, why did you write this book? But also I wanted to ask if you could comment, why did you start with that? So,
sure. Those are two big questions. So I had written my dissertation on the City of God on the theme of idolatry and its relationship to injustice. So working on that, I had spent a lot of time with Augustine's demonology, actually, and I found it was very fruitful for understanding his psychology in general. So perhaps that was in the background as I included this quote at the very beginning of my book, but let me just say a little bit more. So this dissertation was on idolatry and injustice. I was trained by Straussians, and one thing that was really, in some ways, really good about that, though I think there's downsides too, was that I was really encouraged to sit with the City of God and try and understand it before I looked at the secondary literature. So I was actually really far along in writing the dissertation before I dug into the secondary literature on the City of God. And one of the things that really struck me when I did that was the lack of consensus about the status of politics in Augustine's thought. And so this is very striking to me because one of the insights I had as I was working on this dissertation was that, well, Augustine clearly thinks that the earthly city occupies or has taken as its own political life, trying to reshape it in its own image. And so because I had this thought and it was brewing in my mind, it seemed to me that it might actually be worth writing a book about this. It might be worth thinking about the status of politics based on his whole cosmology, Because I think there's a really important connection between the way that he's thinking metaphysically, psychologically, spiritually about the whole of reality and then the things that he says about politics. I didn't want to divorce the two of those. So that was why I ended up writing this book, because it seems to me that I had something to say about the status of politics in his thought, and the question had sort of been left to the side. There had been a lot of debate earlier between those kind of influenced by Rawls, Marcus, for example, who said that, politics is a neutral meeting space for the two cities. And then on the other side of it, you had, no, politics is the realm of sin. It's the realm of the earthly city. And so, because there had been this sort of stagnation in the debate between what you might call the optimists and the pessimists, people were turning to other kinds of questions, questions that seemed answerable, like, what about the Christian citizen? Dodaro has this amazing book about Christ and the just society, or Eric Gregory talking about contemporary ways of inhabiting Augustinianism. So the debates had moved on to questions that seemed more tractable. But I thought, well, maybe if I could make headway on this question or provide a foundation or a framework for thinking about it, people could build on it for other kinds of questions that are also very worth asking with Augustine. So that's why I wrote the book. Why did I pick this quote? Well, like I said, I came to his political thought through his cosmology. Which is not only metaphysical in the way that it relates good and evil, but it's also narratival. So the way that he's unfolding salvation history, the foundation of my reading really is what he says about creation, but then maybe the inverse of that are these moments of fall or rejection of the created order. And I think perhaps the most paradigmatic one of those is not actually the fall of Adam, but rather the fall of Satan. And so it's really astounding. He says that the devil attempts to simulate that which is not, simulare quod non est, right? To counterfeit an unreality. And I thought this language was so striking and really fruitful for thinking about politics.
That's great. Well, and that leads just to my second question, and I know Peter will jump on in at some point here, but is that you really emphasize the language of Augustine trying to instill in his readers a sacramental worldview. What do you
Yeah.
why did you choose that terminology, that framing? What do you mean by that?
That's a great question. So when I first started proposing this language, a lot of people were like, well, do you mean like the seven sacraments? Like, that's a very sort of medieval working out sort of high sacramental theology. And that's not what I was trying to say. So I thought, okay, let me try and articulate this in terms of what came before. And what came before, of course, was Platonism. And so you have this idea of participation or a world that points beyond itself, that pulls in a magnetic way, like through eros, us back to the good. And it seems to me that Augustine is very much in this sense a Christian Platonist, in that at the heart of what he sees when he looks at the created order is things bearing witness to God as their creator. And so what I mean by sacramentality is the world is a pointing thing. The world points beyond itself to the God who made it. And so to be in the world and to encounter the world as something that bears witness to God is to see it as it actually is. And for Augustine, another thing that's really, really tied to this, his role as a rhetorician is to participate in God's work of being a rhetor, right? So God speaks the world into creation. This primordial act of speaking as bringing everything into being is really important for Augustine. And that's where I kind of draw on his sign theory as being very much intricately tied to his understanding of creation ex nihilo. So if it's the case that God speaks the world into being, that means that everything that is has been spoken, which means that it has an intrinsic or original meaning, which is the meaning that the speaker gave to it. So being in being spoken is already intrinsically meaningful, and it's the speaker that endows it with its true meaning. And so, this idea of offering his readers a sacramental worldview is really him trying to help his readers come to see the original meaning of reality as fundamentally speaking of God's love and drawing us back to the God who loves us. So that's what I mean by a sacramental worldview.
Yeah. Before we go into the political implications of that, which I think that's one of the brilliant things in your book, is to tease out the political implications of that. My question is more whether that view of the world, I agree with your philosophical and theological extrapolation of a sacramental universe, sacramental cosmology. My question is whether and to what extent that's actually found in Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking the first couple of books of On Christian Teaching, he's mm-hmm. distinguishing between signs and things. They're, mm-hmm. everything is a thing, obviously, but then among the things that are, there are also things that are signs. And right. it seems like he's using sign as a subcategory of things rather than identifying all things with signs. And I can see how you could tease out his theology of creation to that sacramental conclusion. I haven't seen that in On Christian Teaching. One way to ask the question would be, does Augustine ever use sacramental cosmology or sacramental universe? Is that terminology that he's using, or is that something that you're using to kind of summarize what you're finding?
Yeah.
How explicitly is that developed in Augustine?
Well, he does use the term sacramentum or mystery a great deal as one of his most used words, which is really interesting.
And signum too, right?
Yeah. And signum, yes. So forgive me, it's been a while since I wrote this book, and even longer since I did the research, but from what I remember in book one or book two of De Doctrina, he says that the only thing that is truly res is God. And the way that I understand the signa res distinction is sort of in the way that, you know, in metaphysics, you can talk about matter and form and say, in a certain sense, the wood is the matter to the chair, which the form of the chair. And yet, per se, wood is already informed because it has a form in being wood. So there's a way in which the terms are relational or paired terms. So you can use them in that way. A lamb that really is a lamb is the thing, whereas when my son draws a picture of a lamb, he's pointing to what a lamb is. And so you can identify which of those is a thing and which of them is a sign. But zoom out to the most, just in the same way that you could talk about prime matter in a sort of metaphysical way, you could also talk about the one thing that is thing and not also sign, and that is God. I mean, even Christ, in taking on flesh, points beyond himself, right, back to the Father. And so there's a way in which Christ becomes sign.
Right.
So that's my understanding of it. And I do think he says it somewhere in De Doctrina. I believe it's in chapters one or two, but forgive me for not being able
yeah,
to.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think that's implicit, at least implicit. Maybe it's more explicit than I recall, but I'm thinking, you know, the famous distinction between things to be enjoyed and things to be used has the same kind of force. It's all the mm-hmm. things that are to be used.
Yes.
They're used in order to enjoy the thing that is to be enjoyed, which is God, which means that they are, it's the same kind of relationship that you're describing. I just, it's not clear to me how explicitly Augustine extrapolates that into a full cosmology. But I think the elements are there, I think, certainly. And I'm tracking completely with the theological conclusions you're drawing.
And can we talk about then the Peter was saying the political implications of this whole cosmology you're presenting? Maybe we could discuss that just a little bit, because it's related to the idea of the devil and then us kind of in imitation of the devil.
That's
that
right.
We also try to counterfeit and unreality. That's part of our rejection of the love of God. That's one of the ways you frame it, is that we reject a more day for a more sui. And part mm-hmm. of that is that we try to rewrite reality. We try to counterfeit. But also, you describe the politics of the earthly city or the city of man as parodic, a shadow parody of true politics. Could you elaborate on that and explain what you mean by that? Because I think that's pretty, there's some profound implications of that.
Yeah.
And that the other way you frame that is also that it's as a parody of True Politics, it's also, yeah, you say, trying to impose, the Earthly City trying to impose an anti-sacramental meaning onto creation.
That's right. So maybe it would be helpful probably to the listeners who don't have the book in front of them to read.
Although they should have the book in front of them, right? They should go out and buy it so they can listen to the podcast.
Well, now that it's in paperback, it's at least affordable to someone, yes, other than, you know. Right. So the quote that is the epigraph is this. He refused to be subject to his creator, and in his arrogance supposed that he wielded power as his own private possession and rejoiced in that power. And thus he was both deceived and deceiving, because no one can escape the power of the omnipotent. He has refused to accept reality, and in his arrogant pride presumes to counterfeit an unreality. And so this idea of counterfeiting an unreality in the way that I think Augustine is thinking about it has very much to do with grasping that which has been given to us as gift, right? So this idea that the power that has been given to him in order to serve is something that he delights in as if it were his own possession, is already to re-signify the meaning of the power that he has received, right? And so if this is something that we can use to think about the Earthly City's relationship to politics, for Augustine, this amor sui is always an attitude of grasping or possession, of taking to oneself that which was already to be given, but in order for you to give from it. So if we grasp or cling to that which was given to us as gift, what happens to our political communities? Well, I mean, you could start spelling things out pretty easily there. But this idea that the Earthly City grasps at the things that were supposed to be shared or used to work together to build in a kind of sub-creative way a community of giving and receiving, of working together, of meeting people's needs, when those things are clung to, grasped at, then the whole meaning of political life needs to be re-given, right? And that, I think, is what I mean by an anti-sacramental move that the Earthly City makes, in the way that it's talking about politics even from the beginning, or the way that we do politics, right? If the Earthly City is re-signifying the actions that were supposed to be ones of giving and receiving in the spirit of self-love, then those things are no longer pointing to love, right? In fact, they point away from love, or make you think that actually there is no love in this world, because look at the way people treat each other, right? So it's a sort of anti-sacramentalism that leads to a kind of nihilism or cynicism or radical pessimism about what's possible in politics, or what one has to do in order to have any success in politics.
You know, I think that it as I understood it, the argument is also there's something at a deeper level than that, that anything that any polity or any community that's organized by self-love, inevitably sees that polity as an end in itself, or as a means to self-promotion, self-glorification, which is just fundamentally opposed to any idea that our communities or polities are signs of something else, which is to say signs of a city yet to come. Mm-hmm. Also, if you think of yourself as an end in yourself, then you're just denying what you truly are. Mm-hmm. You use the phrase from I think it's from The Wasteland, the Unreal City, part of Eliot's poem. So it truly is an unreal city, because reality is that things point to God and things are participating in God, and mm-hmm. insofar as you're guided by and dominated by self-love, you're closing out that pointing. It's all pointing back to the self.
That's right.
Now, can I add to that before you make any comments? One of the primary goal. You have a couple of phrases of what you think Augustine's primary goals are in the work, and one of them being, he's trying to liberate his readers from excessive attachment to the world, including political realities. Yeah. This is related to this, right? Because it's kind of the UT Fruity thing a little bit. Yeah. But you're also saying that this type of liberation by returning them back to a more sacramental view towards this worldly goods and created realities. You actually say this paradoxically actually makes them better servants of temporal realities, temporal societies. Can you comment on that and elaborate on those?
Well, I'm glad that you connected it to the hootie-fruity distinction, in part because, I mean, isn't this the logic of possessing? When you try to possess the thing you love, you destroy it and your relationship to it. And that's, all, of course, all the way through the confessions. It's when you love your beloved in God that you see them, you allow them to be what they are in God, and you grow together with them towards God. So there's something fundamentally liberating about loving things in God, including your political community. So in, you know, if you think about the death of Augustine's unnamed friend and the way that he wanted to control that friendship even while his friend was alive, but even afterwards, the way that he felt responsible for keeping his friend's memory in existence after he had died, because he couldn't give it over to God. There's a tremendous burden there. And I think Augustine sees the same kind of burden in those patriots who thought that it was all up to them to make Rome, say, as good as possible. And because they had such a desire for a just city. And so the things that they did for the sake of that just city sometimes crossed the line, right? I mean, Augustine is critical of Seneca, who for the sake of political order deceives the many in pretending that he, you know, was a devout pagan. Or he's critical of Cicero, who thinks for the sake of Rome, we have to make people love glory, right? There are these things where it seems like necessity and the love of a political community that can't be what you so want it to be causes you to, in a certain sense, tragically cross the line in a way that is not good for your political community, actually. And so this is one of the arguments that I think he's really making to his patriotic readers. Look, I'm trying to liberate you from a bad form of necessity. Here's the city that you deeply long for and deeply love. Find your home there. But at the same time, I'm not asking you to forsake the city of Rome that you also love. No, but in separating out the love of that which is perfect versus the love of the thing that, you know, is not perfect, in separating those things out and loving one in the other and loving Rome in city of God and loving Rome as a pilgrim, you can still serve it, but you're liberated from having to serve it in the way that you would have if there was nothing else. So I think that's how his argument unfolds to that particular audience. And he has some really moving passages about it where he appeals to the progeny of Scipio and Fabricius and all these others and know that this is what you've been longing for this whole time.
Yeah, and I think one of the ways that he's doing that, you make the point at the beginning that a lot of commentators and interpreters of Augustine have failed to recognize how he's using the phrase earthly city and the ambiguity of that phrase.
That's right.
In the city of God. Right. On the one hand, it's humanity organized as what the New Testament calls the world.
Yes.
And on the other hand, it's Rome. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't mean to identify those two. So part of the kind of pastoral aim is to make that distinction in his readers, for them to recognize that Rome and a city organized by pride are not identical to each other, and open up the possibility of a new way of engaging in the political world.
That's right. And that's what I call a sort of sacramental citizenship in a certain sense, right? Like a sacramental way of engaging in politics is being able to admit that this is not perfect and I love this in God, and I'm going to try and be a healing presence to the degree that I can, knowing that I can't fix it in a certain sense. When you're talking about the world, actually, so one of the sermons that I talk about in chapter one was a window into thinking about these different meanings of earthly city, actually, because when he's reading John on the world and what Jesus means when he says, you know, I love those in the world, in the way that John is using world in these multivalent ways, and what's the true world versus the world as it's been turned into, and these layers that you see in his exegesis of John and the different meanings of the term world actually map onto the different meanings of the earthly city too, right?
Right. Yeah, I like the way you characterize it as the earthly city in the sense of an existing political community like Rome is not identical to the earthly city in the sense that it's the rebellious community.
That's
but
right.
the rebellious community covets the political realm and desires to dominate it. So you have this, you have this, and I thought that was a really, really good way to put it. Making the, and also the earthly city in the purely negative sense does often dominate the political realm, but still that distinction has to be made so that there's that opens up the possibility for the kind of peaceable and humble political activity that you want to, that Augustine wants to commend.
It does. And if you don't admit the distinction, then in a certain sense, you're falling prey to the pressure that the earthly city is offering, which the earthly city desires. Like, there's part of us that desires to remake the world in the image of what we want it to be. And so if we let one another do that, and we don't make the space for God's meaning in the world to speak, then in a certain sense, it's tragic. I mean, it is really tragic to sort of let politics be what we've made it into.
One of the things I was thinking about when we were talking about the importance of remembering the kind of subordinate or penultimate or sign status of created realities, including our politics, and the liberating from excessive self-love. And you've kind of mentioned, like, to have a love these things in God, that's it's informed by a reality that's not only above it, but also informs it.
Yeah.
So you have this transcendent referent, right? I was thinking a lot of Ernest Fortin's kind of analysis too, that it helps you break free of the constituto, right? That you actually talk about quite a bit in here. And that drew me to, because that's also a big part of his, like, critique of Varro, right? Is like, he can't break free from the customs of the day and their customary framings, even if he doesn't fully buy into them. You know, he's always trying to read between the lines on Varro. But it reminded me of a theme that I really wanted to pick your brain on. Is one of the things, the interesting things that comes up in your book, is this subtle critique of civil religion that you bring up, and you suggest this is a key problem that Augustine's actually addressing, kind of indirectly, maybe. So maybe, can I just ask you, how would you summarize what the issue is with civil religion in Augustine's framework? And how do these two realities address the problem of civil religion that you bring up in your book? Both, one, the Christianization of the empire, you actually suggest, is a way to combat the problems of civil religion. That's one really interesting way. And also, then at the end of your work, you bring up the church as a type of civic disruption. That performs a type, that disruption in itself is a type of psychagogic healing of a sort, in your term. So what's the issue with civil religion?
Yeah.
And also, how do those two phenomena address the problem of civil religion?
So civil religion is very much on Augustine's mind in that the original prompt for writing this book was responding to the pagans who said, you know, we need to return to the way things were, because obviously Christianity is not working out for Rome. And this took, I think, primarily two forms, one of which was a sort of, well, the gods we used to worship have abandoned us because we no longer offer sacrifice to them. And the Christian God, obviously, you know, Constantine thought well of him, but, you know, he doesn't protect us from suffering in the way that the ancient gods did. So we need to return to those. And then there was what you might call a more sophisticated argument for this return to Roman tradition. And that really had to do with the civic function of civil religion, both as a kind of glue for the political community, a set of myths, right, that coalesces an identity. Practices, but then also ways of, maybe for a lack of better word, instilling certain kinds of civic virtues and maybe controlling the people at times of instability. So there are these kind of, let's call them, political arguments for civil religion. And he's addressing both of these in the first, let's say, six or seven books of City of God. So what I think is really interesting about the whole big picture of civil religion is the way in which it's an inversion of order. And here you could again think of Ernest Fortin, right, when he talks about the importance of transpolitical religion. Mm-hmm. What happens when religion becomes a tool either to pacify people by, you know, the poets tell you titillating stories, and then he says the priests and the poets and the politicians were in a fellowship of falsehood in one of his more cynical moments. And by this, I think he means that the plays the poets write, and then the rituals that the priests perform are made use of by the politicians. So, you know, you could think about bread and circuses, or like, you know, the gods are angry. So we'll put on another Circus Maximus, another circus over here, and this or that. And his concern here is that the way that these practices are unfolding is not good for the human beings that are being shaped by them. In a certain sense, they exacerbate and inflame the lower desires, the lower passions, the curiosities of the many. And then they just allow the few who see through them to manipulate the many. And so there's a way in which it's a sort of obfuscation of more power dynamics. And it just doesn't allow people to grow. So when he talks about Christianity, one of the things that he returns to, and this relates to what you said about Varro. So from the philosopher's perspective, well, we see through the illusions of the many, right? We're better than them because we can philosophize, and the many just aren't capable of philosophizing. That would be a philosopher's argument. And then Augustine's, I think, pretty crushing response to Varro is that you couldn't get beyond custom yourself, because actually no human being can. We're just mimetic beings, and we need this gift from God who stoops down, who comes into the world to speak to us. And his constant refrain is, Christ speaks to fishermen and women. And by this, I mean, I'm a woman, but what he's trying to say here is that, like, it's not, the truth is not just for the elite anymore who can ascend. It's for everyone. And guess what? We all already needed it, all of us. Because even if you were a philosopher, there were ways in which custom continued to weigh you down.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem of civil religion is, in a certain sense, it entraps us in the political horizon, so that civil religion just re-echoes the absoluteness of the political horizon. It traps you in it more. Whereas a trans-political religion, to borrow from Fortin here, allows you to see, to get perspective on this cultural horizon and to see the transcendent. And the gift of Christianity is that you don't have to be a philosopher in order to receive that truth. And so it's a liberation of all from the chains of civil religion. Now, when it comes to what he says about the Christianization of the empire, it's interesting. On the one hand, I think it's very true that he celebrates, like, the destruction of the idols, right? This is one way in which politicians can no longer manipulate people, because we can offer this truth. You know, you think about when you read about early converts to Christianity, many of them were slaves, many of them were women. This sort of good news spoke even on a socio-political level. And so that's really interesting. So there is a way in which these practices being no longer institutionalized is a release for Augustine. And I think that's really important. What's also interesting, though, is that it's not a panacea, right? So a sort of Christianization of the empire is not something he leans on very heavily for the promotion of ecclesial life. I think, you know, being post Constantius, post all of the Arian controversies, he's pretty wary of the ways in which, when an emperor or emperor's mother decides on which side of a theological controversy, that things can go pretty south pretty quickly. And so the wedding of a kind of religious optimism that you might see in a Lactantius or a Eusebius is just not there with him. And it's interesting how little he says in praise of Constantine, particularly when you contrast it to things that Eusebius says, right? I think that there's actually one passage in City of God that is a direct knock on a passage that Eusebius says about why Constantine was blessed by God.
Yeah, we looked at that. We just discussed this in class, and
oh,
I was
really?
Inspired by your work as well, thinking about it. Also, you mentioned fascinating what you mentioned about what he flags about Theodosius, right? Who even takes the Constantinian measures further. But what Augustine chooses to focus on, which is very Mary Key's inspired humility, right? I mean, but which is fascinating. But the Constantine thing, it is interesting. What he draws attention to is how brief his rule was, and so he's trying to actually liberate you. It's like in my tradition, it's like in the neo-Calvinist reformed tradition that I'm a part of here at this institution, we call it it's like a common grace logic. Is like God bestows empire on the just and the unjust so
right.
that we would not hold on to it too tightly.
That's right.
That's kind
right.
of what he says about Constantine, right? Is that what you're drawing attention to?
Yes, absolutely. And he, you would expect him to say, well, so someone like Eusebius is going to say that God in his providence put Constantine on the throne so that Christianity could be spread. And Augustine just talks about the martyrs, right? He just says that the martyrs are really the ones that bore witness. And that is really what caused the conversions that we saw. So it's interesting what he chooses to say and what he chooses not to say.
Just one point on the Constantine thing. He does give Constantine kind of short shrift. At the same time, he doesn't do the Anabaptist thing and say the Constantine was a betrayal of the martyr witness. He does see the martyr witness somehow coming to fruition in the conversion of the empire to the extent that it's converted. But the question I wanted to actually talk about was something going back to your comments on Varro, which seems to be in your book, it's part of a section where Augustine is analyzing the way that self-love and pride are just worked into all the institutions and cultural norms of the Roman Empire. And so to the extent that there are solutions proposed that still are based on that self-love,
right,
they're just more of the problem.
That's right. Yeah.
And Varro fits into that, I guess, partly because there's this this false promise of philosophy. A few philosophers can come out of the cave of custom and find the truth, but it's only a few. And so they kind of lord themselves over the masses who can't philosophize.
Right.
Or the one that the example that I really enjoyed was Augustine's discussion of the beginning of the, or not the beginning of the Aeneid, but the vision of Rome at the middle of the Aeneid, where the Rome is going to be the nation that will crush the proud. And Augustine says, well, actually, that's, even though you're stating opposition to pride, it's actually an act of pride to state that kind of opposition, because you're usurping God's role of humbling the proud. So, and it got to a kind of a methodological issue that came home to me again reading your book, is the way that Augustine is able to move back and forth between the loves of the heart, which are the kind of the foundations of political order for good and ill. And the institutions or the practices, the customs that express that love. And you have this kind of mutual relation between the two, that the pride produces certain kinds of ways of life. And then those ways of life tend to reinforce the loves that produce them. And you end up having this whole civilization that's founded on pride.
Right. Right. I think there was a question about cultural renewal earlier, but that's exactly what cultural renewal has to breathe into, right? Like, how do you, if we've got this enclosing funnel where I already have these natural or fallen orientations, and then my society puffs air into them so that they only become stronger in me, and then gives me stories that emboldens me in doing these things. That's suffocating, isn't it? And so a cultural renewal has to expand the imagination and bear witness to something beyond this increasingly stifling atmosphere. when you were talking, it reminded me also of that scene is just a striking example of parity at work, right? Because to spare the humble and beat down the proud is in itself a parody, a counterfeit imitation of what God says, where he says he resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. And so the movement of beating down the proud is what I'm going to do. Oh, but you grovel, I'll spare you, is the exact opposite of God, who moves towards the humble, but it's only because the pride in us can't receive him, that he can't give. And so this vision of parody works out from the beginning, like from the first page of City of God, and mapping the two cities and self-love and love of God, weaving them together as throughout the whole book.
Yeah, and Virgil's parody, I'm not conscious, surely, but Virgil's parody is pretty clever, because it kind of, you can see how it kind of echoes with the biblical portrait of what God is doing. But as you say, Augustine is pointing out that it's actually a statement of pride in Rome's role in history.
And I also appreciated what you said about if it's the case that our institutions are already in a certain way animated by not only our good loves, but our loves that pull us back towards ourselves, our self-loves. And then we, on top of it, are shaped by this. The question is, what can break into that? And that's where I think for him, it has to start with Christ. And it doesn't start with us as Christians. It starts with Christ. And that's even evident from the very beginning, the way that he maps on who is doing the saving in the story at the beginning, where the Christians usher the Romans into the biggest churches, right? It's Christ who is doing that directing. So his return to Christ is really important, because we can't imagine that because we're Christians, we're without pride, right? Like, he's not a Pelagian, and obviously he's not a Pelagian. That's but instead, this is so important for Augustine, that everything he says about the earthly city tells us about our own hearts too. And so when we're starting to think about political solutions, everything that he's saying about Rome is already the caveat to any work that we're trying to do.
Yeah. So it's Chesterton. What's wrong with the world? I am.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right.
I was going to ask you a connection for contemporary relevance related to the humility point, which, interesting, I think it's worth reflecting on, just a side note about like how the Christ breaking in to help you burst out of the limitations of the civil religion, right? That where the Imperium is trying to impress its vision of the world upon you, and how Christ breaks in and helps us break free from that. One thing about, I guess I'll just make the note here, I can't remember who wrote a really great essay on this, but I wrote in my margins. It's kind of like the civil religion, where it hands you these visions that it wants you to subscribe to and embrace yourself. This author, it might have been Jennifer Hurt, it could have been Cavadini, I can't remember. It was in one of those volumes where they all wrote these really good essays. But I wrote in my, it's kind of like the mirror of empire, right? It's trying to make you in its own image.
Yes.
And that's kind of the way he like ties the libido dominandi, right? Like the empire is driven by this, but also it's trying to press that on you. But the mirror of empire makes us men without chests, right? Kind of tying to the Lewis thing, because then we can't actually break free from what we're handed. We actually can't be courageous. So it's interesting to try to think about how humility helps us break free from that. But kind of the question, maybe you could talk about that, but the question for contemporary relevance I was having is, you know, he's trying to constantly subvert the desire for glory, right? And it's a really strategic way he opens up his book, right? By praising glory, but it's the glory of the city of God, right? But he's subverting, right, the Roman pursuit, vision of what glory is. And you comment, right, like the pursuit of glory, though it could be a public good, you know, that the empire wants us all to pursue glory, and as a unit pursue glory, you say it can't actually create community.
Right.
Would you say that maps neatly onto, you know, it's like a private good of a sort, even though it can be publicly valued. But would you say that maps well onto our contemporary moment? Or would you say it, maybe it's not the pursuit of glory, it's something, what would the other thing be where we could see the relevance for today that Augustine might speak to, that it's a publicly enshrined value that though is divisive and inherently competitive and dissolves community?
Yes.
So if Augustine was writing City of God today, maybe he wouldn't focus so much on glory as problematic, but what else would he?
Yeah. What about performativity? Because it seems to me that, you know, the curated self, our online presence, the ways in which we posture for likes, a sense of how I'm seen. I mean, this is not too far from glory, actually. And, and you know, the constant selfie taking. I don't know. I think that he might take issue with the unreality of our digital culture, actually, in that what kind of communities are we forming online? How easy is it to like something, and how hard is it to build community with, say, people in your actual church, right? Like, how do you get to know people? How do you know their concrete needs? Thick community is really different than online community, where it's either really harsh criticism or really empty affirmation, responding to the ways that we've postured for the sake of a kind of approval. So I think that he would take issue with the kind of unreality to that, and the way in which it doesn't actually fill us. Like, one of the remarkable things about what he says about the Roman heroes is the lengths that they went, that were forms of self-mutilation, essentially, to gain a name for themselves in Rome. Mm-hmm. And what lengths do we try to go to in order to be looked at or to be noticed? And how much of that is because those concrete embodied relationships that mediate God's love to us, you know, are shriveling in some way. So I don't know. I have That's a great. Sense that might be a direction that he would go. And we can all talk about how performativity is totally undermined political life, right? There's no room for deliberation and difficult conversations anymore.
That's great.
I want to go back to James's point about the church. You don't think Augustine was a realist who identifies the Rome with the earthly city?
That's right.
You don't think he's a liberal either.
Correct.
But you also don't think he's an integralist who thinks the church as an institution kind of dominates public space.
Right.
But still, the church is disruptive. And you talk about the necessary and salutary tension that the church introduces into political life. One of the things that I thought was, it is very close to what we're interested in, is the role that worship plays in that disruption. Mm-hmm. And it's all bound up with the sacramental universe and your emphasis on gifts, creation as gift. That's central to your thesis.
That's a great question. So it seems to me that when the point of our action is to be performative or to disrupt, then our religion becomes civil religion, right? So the task of the church, it seems to be, is to keep its eyes on where it's journeying to, right? So this idea of the pilgrim church as a real community that is living together, journeying together. There's worship is the heart of it, because, you know, what he says about Latreia or worship is Christ reveals to us that we are the gift that we offer to God. Christ, mm-hmm. the head, we are his body. He offers himself, meaning he offers us, and he teaches us what it means to offer ourselves, which has to be offering ourselves in him, not striking our own tune, but in harmony with the kind of sacrifice that he offered, which again goes back to the importance of humility. So, you know, this would be why I part ways with a certain, you know, integralism understood as the path being taking power, right? It seems to me that yes, cultural renewal is so important. But I also think that you can't renew culture by trying to renew culture. It seems to me that renewal comes by setting your eyes on something higher and retrieving and restoring what has been lost and found and lost again and again, right? To go back and quote Eliot some more. But we're in this moment of retrieval and recovery and restoration. And what that means is we have to work on our thick communities on the parish level, you know, to speak as a Catholic, but, you know, on your church level, right? Mm-hmm. So worship is something that discloses what it is that our whole life as a church community should be about, which is learning to love. And I think, again, going back to what I was saying earlier, it's those concrete relationships with other people that we actually learn to love. Like, I have two really young children, and I love them very much, but sometimes it's really hard to love them. And that's where I learn how little I love is in trying to love them well, and failing to love them well, and then trying again to love them well. And so it's sort of the concreteness of the life of the church that I think is the fruit of the worship in a temporal sense. And I think that's what can renew or bear witness. But I think it's a danger to sort of try and become performative and make your task to disrupt, if that makes sense. I don't know. I get a little bit nervous.
Just to summarize, you're bringing together a number of the themes of your book, and worship is the cure because it's sacrifice, mm-hmm. self-offering in Christ, which is an antidote to pride. Mm-hmm. It's thanksgiving, which recognizes all things as gift. And mm-hmm. so you're actually, when you're worshiping, you're actually engaging in reality as it actually is.
That's right.
Instead of what you want to make of it, it's God's gift to you. And that means that it's also a testimony to the sacramental character of reality. Right. So all those things that Augustine sees as essential to a proper engagement with reality and vision of reality are all happening mm-hmm. and expressed in the church's worship.
That's right. And in that way, it's a real formation of us. And it's an ongoing formation, right? An ongoing healing pilgrimage. But it is a kind of formation that we perhaps need in order to be a healing presence in our political communities. But again, I wouldn't want to say that it's so that we can be a healing presence right. in our mm-hmm. people. That's right.
Yeah, it reminds me of this great quote that you had, where you're trying, you say Augustine's trying to present Christianity as a better religion for the civitas than Roman religion. And Augustine suggests that the patriot need not abandon his concern for Rome in order to join the city of God. This is on page 115, if people want to look at it. Instead, it provides a foundation for all the virtues that benefit political community. Nevertheless, this is the key point that reflects your logic that you just said, is this is only half of Augustine's strategy. He does not want his patriotic readers to embrace Christianity merely because it is politically useful. He wants them to embrace it because it's true. Accordingly, Augustine must also present the city of God as a better object of devotion than Rome is. And it made me, when I was reading that, it made me think of, there's all these, there's an interesting phenomenon right now of what you could call culture war converts to Christianity, right. or, especially among the old new atheists. You know, Ion Hershey Ali, I think, was the one who just recently. It's a fascinating story. We actually analyzed it in class, and I don't mean to judge anybody's conversion story cynically at all. And I pray that conversion would continue to be fruitful and real. But it was fascinating, the narration of it, right? Which is at this initial stage, it was largely in many ways motivated because Christianity helps keep Western civilization alive. Yeah. And that might be a great place to start, but we don't want to present Christianity and the church that way as the primary reason yeah. to come to Christ.
My example would be Joe Rogan crying out to Jesus, Jesus, please.
That's right. That's right. That was a recent one. Yeah.
Yeah. I do think God can be pretty sneaky in the way that he gets into our hearts. So, mm-hmm. you know, One never knows, but yeah, in terms of laying out theoretically the importance, right, of not subverting in terms of order of loves, it's really important to keep hammering that one home. And also just in terms of a renewal of culture, if we do things so that we'll have a renewal of culture, again, the same possible of externalities merely arises. But I could just talk forever, so I'm just going to stop and say thank you so much for these wonderful questions and for our conversation. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anywhere that our audience can find you and also follow your work? And is there anything particular you're working on right now that you want to share about?
Well, that's a great question. Right now, I'm working on something by a Catholic 20th century philosopher, theologian called Romano Guardini. Mm-hmm. It's some of the comments that I made at the end came out of this, that I've been really interested in thinking about thick forms of community and what they do to help shape us into what we ought to be, and liturgy and liturgical communities. And then kind of as a foil of that, digital so-called communities or digital platforms, as a kind of parody of it. So to return to my thoughts about parody, that's an immediate project I'm working on. I have a long-term project where I'm trying to work through Rousseau's thought. And my very large thesis is that Rousseau tries to be a new Augustine that's an anti-Augustine. And the way that he understands...
Confessions.
Yes. So he wrote a Confessions, which is, I think, a subversion of Augustine's Confessions in really important ways. I have an article coming out soon about how his second discourse is an anti-Augustinian fable by presenting the natural savage man instead of Adam as our origin story. So I think there's lots going on in Rousseau where he understands the importance that Augustine had for Western culture, and he tries to do the same thing but with a different message. So yeah, that's a long-term book project I'm working on.
Those are very Civitas friendly projects, so we look forward to seeing what comes out of that. Well, we will let you go, and thank you so much for joining us. Our followers, please follow Dr. Ogle's work. It's very exciting. If you liked this podcast episode, please leave a review and listen, pay attention for upcoming interviews and conversations. Thanks so much for listening.